So Rich took you from deuterium through helium-3, helium-4, and lithium-7. I'm going to then carry us all the way through boron. So I'll hit lithium-6, which Rich left for me, and then talk about beryllium and boron, and talk about how they're made actually in the galaxy, but ultimately what we're trying to be interested here in this meeting for particle physics is about pre-galactic, potentially early universe production of some combination of lithium-6, beryllium, and boron, and cosmic rays are going to show up as a competing source. And so so I'll actually spend most of my time talking about cosmic rays. I'll mention something about dark matter decays, but after all, almost everybody in this room has been involved in dark matter decays and could give that talk, so I will actually say very little about that. But I've spent some time thinking about cosmic rays, and not as many people here have talked about that, so I'll focus there, although Grant could give that part of the talk. So Grant could give this entire talk. So without further ado then. Right. So before I get carried away, I want to be sure you know who my partners in crime are. So they're listed here. And again, some of them either are in this room, you just heard from Rich, or Keith is going to be here soon. And I particularly just wanted to point out the people that are color-coded in blue to draw your eye. Those are the people who did the real work. They were either graduate students or postdocs or some combination somewhere along the line. Vasilis wished he could be here, and Tiana Prodanovic has done some very nice work. She's in Serbia. She's now gone back to Serbia, and she's now actually the Carl Sagan of Serbia. So within a couple of years, she already managed to do that. But she's also doing some very interesting science, and I'll be telling you about that. Okay, so I'm going to begin with my conclusions. So if we get carried away with discussion, that's fine. You already know what my conclusions are. So again, we're interested in lithium-6, beryllium, and boron, and their production in cosmic rays versus, say, dark matter decays. So first, I'll talk about the observations. What do we actually know about lithium-6, beryllium, and boron in the early galaxy, or even before the early galaxy? And it looks like there's some pre-galactic component of potentially lithium-6, and I'll talk about what we know about some pre-galactic or primordial component of beryllium or boron. And once I've said something about the observations, then we'd like to understand them. And I'll talk about producing lithium, beryllium, and boron, both guaranteed sources and maybe not so guaranteed sources. Guaranteed sources are galactic cosmic rays. And so I'll spend a fair amount of time talking you through that. And then, so these are cosmic rays like we know and love in our galaxy today. The question is, could there have been things producing lithium, beryllium, and boron before our galaxy was even born? That would be pre-galactic production. And it turns out there are sources. We all know about the dark matter. Everybody in this room does. But it turns out there are also cosmic rays that very likely were came into existence before the galaxy was even formed, these so-called cosmological cosmic rays. And I'll say a little bit about those and about how we might hope to disentangle these two sources, because we either would like to learn about these early particle accelerators, or we'd like to learn about dark matter, but we'd like to not be confused, and I'll talk about how we might go between the two. Okay. But first things first, I want to talk about the observations. Now, this is the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics, and I'm certainly not an observer. But I think I might be the only person here with my appointment is actually predominantly in an astronomy department. And so, you know, it's an astronomy department, and indeed some of my best friends talk to observers. So I'm going to take it upon myself to try to give some sense of what the observational status is. So Rich sort of alluded to some of this, but I want to expand on it. So we're looking for lithium, beryllium, and boron, and we're looking for fossils. We're trying to understand not so much what's going on today, although we'd like to understand that, but what was going on in the early universe and the early galaxy with these elements. And why do we care? Well, lithium-6, beryllium, and boron are sort of the orphans of nucleosynthesis, in the sense that they aren't made in stars, and they aren't made, at least in standard Big Bang nucleosynthesis. And why they're not made in standard beginning nuclear synthesis is fairly clear to this audience. Why they aren't made in stars is because they're very fragile. After all, next to deuterium, they're the most fragile things around in terms of binding energy. And stars destroy them at moderate temperatures. Merely a couple of million Kelvin is enough to destroy these things. So stars not only don't produce lithium-6, beryllium, and boron, in fact, they're net destroyers of them. So they aren't made in stars, aren't made in the Big Bang, or at least the standard Big Bang, so we've got to find another source. And so what they're really telling you about is non-stellar energetic processes. So aside from the intrinsic interest in lithium for, say, your computer batteries or psychoactive medication, they really are trying to tell us about energetic processes in the early galaxy and early universe. So we'd like to learn about them. And happily, they are detectable. And where you detect them is in the atmospheres of primitive stars, which is to say the lingo being population 2 or the halo of our galaxy, not the dark matter halo, but the stellar halo, say the spherical distribution, spherish distribution of old stars in our galaxy, not traced out by globular clusters, but they're also field halo stars, and that's mostly where these come from. So that's where we'll be looking. So these are these old low metallicity stars. The trouble is, not just any star will do. We need to look at a hot star, a hot halo star, because it has to have a thin convection zone. Because otherwise, if the star has a deep convection zone, it takes the lithium from the atmosphere, where we want to observe, drags it down to where it's really hot, and then it destroys the lithium, or the beryllium, or the boron, and that's bad news. And it turns out that hot stars have thin convection zones, and so even though the atmosphere is hot, the lithium never sees regions that are hot enough to destroy it. So it turns out we're going to look at fairly warm halo stars, and that will become an issue presently. Okay, so what can we actually, so these are detectable. What do we actually measure? What you measure are the absorption lines, really, of lithium, beryllium, and boron, as well as other species like hydrogen or metals in each halo star. So you go from halo star to halo star, and you measure as many abundances as you can or you get funded for. And the abundance you see in any given star is telling you about what the composition of the material was like when the star was born, when and where the star was born. So it's remembering the condition of its own birth, because the atmosphere of the star will never get dragged down. Again, it will never get dragged down to the center of the star to know anything about the nucleosynthesis of the core. So you're seeing what the conditions were like when the star was born, not what it's doing now at its core. So what we would like to do then, so we'll measure all of these lithium, beryllium, boron, and these other things, hydrogen metals, in all of these stars. And we'd really like to know is how lithium, beryllium, and boron evolved, ideally versus some nice physical variable like time or redshift. So what's the time evolution, redshift evolution of lithium, beryllium, and boron? That's not so easy, because these observables don't come with a clock built into them. But fortunately, there's still a way to proceed, and that's the following idea. We don't measure time directly, but we do measure heavy elements. We do measure metals. And so we can use metals themselves as a measure of galactic evolution. The idea being, as the galaxy turns on, we start with gas, initially primordial gas. That gas is processed into stars and molecular clouds or objects like that. The stars live their lives and die. If they happen to be supernovae, they die rather spectacularly. And then once they've gone, they leave behind some remnant, a white dwarf if it's a low-mass star, a neutron star, a black hole if it's a high-mass star. But most of the mass of the star is ejected into space and then mixes with the gas that's surrounding it and enriching it. And then we just continue around, lather, rinse, repeat. And so as a result, the net effect of building generations of stars is metal abundances go up, and, for example, deuterium abundances go down. But it's this metal abundance increase with time that we care about, because that says that if you measure both lithium, beryllium, boron, and a metal, for example, oxygen or iron, then this trend is a measure of evolution. Systems with a low metal abundance were born, they're recording the environment conditions when the systems were not very processed, when there had not been much star formation. Systems at higher metallicity were born later when there had been more stellar processing. So metallicity, it might not increase in time in a simple way, but because metallicity goes up with time, metallicity is a proxy for evolution. That's the basic idea. And one can make detailed models of this, but the basic conclusion is model independent. So we do this, and again, Rich said a little bit about this, but just to give you my sort of spin on this. So let's first look at lithium, in particular, so at the moment just elemental lithium, so let's not worry about isotopes quite yet. And lithium being something that we all love and care about. Observers care about it as well, and lithium has been very well studied in stars in our galaxy that have both low and high metallicity. And in fact, this plot doesn't even show all the points, but there's quite a lot of data. And so the basic trend is plotted here. And so what I'm showing you are lithium abundances, the ratio of lithium to hydrogen, as a function of metallicity in astronomers' units, where this is the iron abundance compared to the iron abundance of the sun. So that's solar, 10 to the minus 1 solar, 10 to the minus 2 solar, and so forth. So it's a log scale. But for sort of a first blush, if you haven't, your coffee hasn't set in yet, you can just think of this as a measure of time. So these stars were born when there had not been much metal production, so this is the early part of the galaxy, and this is the late part of the galaxy, and the sun is there. So this is a log-log plot of lithium abundance versus metallicity, or if you like, versus some measure of time or evolution. So what do you see? Well, lithium starts low and then goes up, and that's where it is today. That's the solar system abundance there. And so because lithium rises with metallicity or time, that means as stars are forming and producing metal, lithium is also going up. And so what that tells you is that there are galactic sources of lithium. And in fact, the solar number is like 10 times this. So galactic sources of lithium are the dominant source of the lithium that's in your computer battery or your psychoactive medicine. So lithium increases with metallicity. It's correlated with star formation. Stars in the galaxy, processes in the galaxy anyway, are producing lithium. All right? But if you look back at low metallicity, then something interesting happens. And this is, of course, this famous result that's now more than two decades old. As you go back towards low metallicity, sure, the lithium abundance goes down. And I apologize, there's data that fills this in, and the curve goes down. But then, after you go down to about a tenth of solar metallicity, maybe a 10 to the minus 1.5, then the lithium flattens out, and it doesn't go down anymore. So no matter how low you go in metallicity, you don't anymore see a drop-off in lithium. So no matter how early in time I'm looking, the lithium abundance doesn't go down, but it stays the same. And so we see a constant abundance in early epochs, and that's a profound result. It's trying to tell us that lithium is primordial. So this plateau versus metallicity, this steep plateau, is telling you that lithium is primordial.
Is there a reason why the sun has such a high abundance of lithium compared to other?
So I apologize again that this. So this data was, I was careful how I picked these points. These points were picked more to give you a sense of what the scatter is. This is not sort of a fair comparison. This is something that I mentioned before, and I thank you for asking because I'm not going to say much more about it, is that you have to look carefully to find stars that are appropriate for looking at lithium because of this business that the stars have these convection zones that want to destroy their lithium. So these stars up here have thin convection zones so that they don't destroy their lithium. So their atmospheric lithium is telling you what they were born with. These guys are actually lower temperature star, different mass star, basically. They have deeper convection zones. They've destroyed their lithium. So this is a more diverse set of stars. These are a very carefully picked set of stars that only have that are similar masses and similar surface temperature, similar structure, so they don't destroy their lithium. All this observational stuff could easily be a talk by itself because this is an important point. So the truth is, if I picked these stars the same way I picked those stars, you would only see the upper envelope. Similarly, if here I showed you stars with lower temperatures, they would fill down here. But the idea is, if you look at hotter and hotter stars, eventually this depletion effect goes away, and it doesn't continue going up. It stops, and that's where this plateau is.
So that's further myth and magic I didn't even show you a plot of, but that's a whole analysis by
just by eye, looking at this concentrated point, there's still some sort of...
We're getting to that point. Well, let me wait for a second, we'll get to that point, whether or not there's actually a slope here. But certainly, what you can here, you can see that there's a rather steep trend, and now if there is some kind of trend, it's not very steep. But there may well be a trend, and that might be of great interest in a few minutes. Okay.
Specifically, the ratio of lithium and hydrogen in these atmospheres?
Yes, that is what that is. So that's right. So you measure the hydrogen through a Balmer line or something like that, and you measure lithium through a line, B line that you can measure, and then take the ratio. I'll say a little bit more about what goes into that, because that's also a crucial issue. But for now, it's the best estimate of the total amount of lithium to the total amount of hydrogen as recorded by the atmosphere. Okay, so that's all well and good, and it's beautiful that we see lithium as primordial because we theorists all know that lithium is supposed to be primordial, so that's all very good, and makes Dave Schramm smile down upon us. But there's this peculiar thing. Although lithium is primordial, is this plateau we see, is it really a measure of the primordial lithium abundance? It tells you lithium is primordial, but does it give you the primordial abundance? And that's not so clear. Because as Rich was telling you, WMAP finds a cosmic baryon density. And if you take that baryon density and compute the lithium abundance, what you get is something 2 to 3 times higher than where the actual data lie. And this little band is my attempt to illustrate that. And so this band is where WMAP says lithium ought to be. And you'll notice that that is completely disjoint from the points I'm showing you.
Three alpha reaction, and now very precise value of WMAP is probably.
It might be narrower than that. Yeah, it might be narrower than that.
By a factor of two, I think.
So, there are more careful ways to do this. This is just for illustration purposes. That's supposed to give you a flavor for what's going on. So that's a discrepancy, and we'd like to understand that. And so now this gets more into the astrophysical dirt. So let me just get, and Rich alluded to some of this, but we're now into the real world and therefore somewhat messy regime of systematic uncertainties. And this, so we have plenty of stars. It's not a question of not enough statistics. What we need is an understanding of systematics. And they come in several flavors of what I might call observational and astrophysical. Observationally, this gets back to one of the questions that was just asked. What are we really measuring here? What you measure, it's a particular line. It's 6,700 angstroms or so. A particular transition in lithium, and it's in neutral lithium, in astronomical lingo, lithium 1. It's in neutral lithium you're seeing an absorption line. And from that, you get the lithium to hydrogen ratio. However, it turns out in these stars, they're pretty hot. Most of the lithium is ionized. So it's singly ionized. What's in the lingo is lithium 2. So you're measuring a subdominant ion compared to the main species. And so that's OK, because we know something about the temperatures of these stars. And so you can make a correction for that. We know about ionization. There's not mystery here. And this has long been known. But the trouble is, if for some reason you were misestimating the temperature, if there were a systematic error in the temperature, then that could change the lithium abundance. Because if the star was hotter than you thought, then your subdominant species was more subdominant than you thought, and you should give it more correction. The trouble is, to correct it enough, you need the temperature scale to be off by a lot. 500 Kelvin, remember these are like 6,000 Kelvin, and 500 Kelvin is a lot. So if you talk to an observer, it's very hard to get it's a difficult problem for them, so it's hard to get them to completely rule it out, but this is actually a pretty big shift for them. So this is sort of at the edge of what the observations would let you do. But it's not ruled out, and this may be a large part of the answer.
One nice effects that it's not much harder what you actually do have.
And that's another example of such an effect. And so people are worried about us all seeing more about some of these kind of things. All of these issues come into play now. To just step back, what's really going on here, in my view, is that precision cosmology is now
come to meet stellar abundance astrophysics, and they've never needed to know things this well. It's never before been such an issue that you care about stellar temperatures so to this kind of precision. And so now all of these effects people haven't thought about before, and I'll name a few, and then NLMCE is a good example, and there are other ones, that are now coming into play, that for sort of rough work is fine, but for what we need to know now, we have to have a better understanding. So, and of course, another thing you'd like to do, and I'll say this first thing at the top, is just find another place to measure. We have different systematics, so you have something else to compare with. Okay, so those are some of the observational issues, and those could be a large part of the problem. Now, there's also what I would say is more of an astrophysical systematic, which is to say, even if the observations are correctly reporting the present lithium abundance of the star, it's the present lithium abundance that's lived for the lifetime of the galaxy, which is most of the age of the universe, or 10 to 10 years.
If the stars have managed to destroy some of their lithium, then what you're measuring isn't the primordial level because there's been some destruction, and you should correct upwards. And that, of course, is the right direction. So, you might think, well, that's it. That's the solution to the problem. Well, people have tried to look at this in some detail. In fact, a lot of people, not more than just the names I showed, by going to very high signal-to-noise data. And I showed some of this in the last plot. And what you find is very striking. First of all, this lithium plateau, if you make a very careful measurement of in a statistically uniform way and you sample the same way observationally, the lithium plateau is very thin. That is, the scatter from star to star across the plateau is very small. And so that puts big constraints on depletion, because you can think of ways for stars to destroy its lithium, but those processes should depend on details that change from star to star, for example, rotation rates. And so if you're clever enough, you can think of ways to arrange for all stars to deplete lithium by a factor of two, but it's non-trivial to get them to do it in such a way that the rotation rates, any of the other details of the star, are insensitive to this. And so this thinness of the lithium plateau is actually a major constraint. But the other thing is that these observers, most people have looked at this recently, find, in fact, this thing that Maxime was pointing out, that it looks like there is actually a tilt, there's a small rise in lithium versus iron, which is to say lithium versus time. So that if lithium's actually coming up, that means there's some galactic source of lithium. And if you want to get the primordial component, you want to subtract out the galactic part. And that's going to correct lithium downward, which is actually the wrong thing to do. That says you should move the observations downward, which is not the direction that WMAP wants to go. But that's life. I'm just telling you what you got to do. But that does tell you there has to be galactic lithium production, and then you'd like to have a mechanism for that.
Hopefully, all these issues should not depend on what we want.
Sure. Well, that's what I'm saying. So this thing goes down, and no, it's not convenient for us, but that's life. That's where
it may be convenient for some other people, right?
So,
galactic cosmic ray lithium production on your last slide, and because of the slope.
Yeah, and well, you're right. So I said galactic. I haven't yet said it's cosmic ray, I said it's galactic. If it correlates with iron, that tells you that it's a galactic source.
Definitely. But the thing is, what worries me is that there's many groups determining lithium 7 abundances.
That's
not just those two groups. And if you make a list of all those groups, there's probably around 10 maybe or 8, about half of them find a slope and the other one do not. And it almost seems a bit like the ones which have a low value, they find a slope, and the ones which do not have a low value, I don't know if correlation is so strong, but they do not find.
Yeah, what you say is totally right, that there's debate about whether this slope is there.
Something else not really understood.
What you're saying is totally right. There's several groups doing lithium abundances, and there it's very hard to disentangle. Like they typically use different, somewhat different data sets and somewhat different assumptions. It's very hard to get this to sort of completely sort all of this out. The analyses I was talking about, the benefit of them, they were not combining different data sets. They had one data set with one set of observations making the same telescope. So it was designed in such a way to try to look for these kind of systematic trends. So even if they had some systematic offset in the absolute abundance, they were just trying to see if there's a slope
that was the purpose there. So that was designed to do this, because as soon as you combine from different experiments, then you have to worry about other issues. But your point is still well taken, that this whole slope business is a controversial thing, because it's sort of right at the edge of what we're able to do. So, all right, well, to move on, beryllium and boron. So we can observe them, and the observables are, well, for both of them, you observe a line and a star. In beryllium, the line is observable from the ground. So this is just some nuts and bolts of an astronomical thing, but it matters. Beryllium, you can actually observe the line from the ground, so you can use a ground-based telescope. Boron, the line is in the UV, and you have to observe it from space. So it doesn't even make it to the ground, that region of the spectrum. And so you just don't get as many points in boron because you got to go to space, and then you got to compete for time on space telescopes, which have smaller apertures and so forth. So.
And then on the lines
of the boron. Oh, yeah, let's see. So for boron, let's see, the isotopes are, they're blended together. I'll say more about how that works with lithium. It's a similar story with boron, but worse. Yeah, So here we go. So here are the trends versus metallicity. So what do you see? Oh, just to get you in the mood, I put some set of the lithium data here to show you. Here's how lithium, again, plotting versus metallicity in a log scale and abundance this way. This I already showed you. There's lithium, and here's that's total lithium. And this is an earlier set. I apologize. It's an old plot. It's an earlier set of some of the lithium 6 points. I'll say more about lithium 6 now, so let's not get carried away with that. This is just to show you on the same axis, I want to show you what beryllium and boron look like. So again, log abundance versus metallicity. And what you see is that here, they certainly are not a scatter. There's a strong correlation. There are little curves to guide the eye, but don't worry about the curves at the moment. Just look at the data, and you'll see that both beryllium and boron certainly correlate with metallicity. And so they don't just correlate, they rise with metallicity, so that tells you that there's a galactic source of both beryllium and boron, and we'd like to know what that is. But you'll notice that there is not a clear evidence for a plateau. This kind of behavior is not reproduced for beryllium and boron. So first of all, this just shows you don't always find a plateau. I don't want to give you that impression. Lithium is very special that way. Beryllium and boron don't show an obvious evidence for a plateau. I mean, the thing is always the data gets ratty down at the end, but when you're, except for the edge of the data, there's no obvious evidence for a plateau. So I would say then there's no clear observed evidence for primordial beryllium and boron. So the upper limits on what's primordial or pre-galactic, say, is whatever the lowest observed abundance is. So you can say, if I had a plateau, where could I put it and not spoil the observation? So for example, if I tried to put a beryllium plateau here, that would be hard to understand, because why is this stuff below it? If that was what if you started with that minimum amount and then added a galactic source. Now, not finding a plateau isn't a terrible thing. Not finding pre-galactic components is not a terrible thing necessarily, because that's after all consistent with what standard Big Bang nuclear synthesis says, where you find that the beryllium and boron should be way below the kind of level they shouldn't even, you couldn't draw them on these plots. They would be, you know, far below both panels. Okay. And then finally, lithium 6. Our friend that we've come here to discuss. So lithium 6 is indeed observable. So the good news is you can actually measure the ratio. And that's thanks to an isotope shift, in this case where the 6 isotope has an absorption line that's a little shorter than the 7 isotope. Sorry, not sure I got that. I'm terrible with inequalities. Longer, I'm sorry. It's redward. So there's 6, and the plot has it right. There's 6 and there's 7. So there's a slight shift. Now notice it's a tiny shift. It's a fraction of an angstrom. But there is an isotope shift. And in the local interstellar medium, so you look at a nearby star, and between us and the star, you see any interstellar gas. And in the local interstellar medium, these are real data, and it's beautifully resolved. You can really see the isotope split. So that's a gorgeous, gorgeous thing. So that's the good news. It's possible to separate the isotopes. It's a fantastic thing. The bad news is we don't want, or our purpose here is not to look at cold gas today in the galaxy, but to look in the early galaxy in halo stars. And in halo stars, the atmospheres are hot. Remember I told you that they're hot.
And so they have this big thermal broadening effect, and that broadens out. Now, these aren't on the same, quite the same scale, but it's, the point is there, that they, it broadens out the line, and so the thermal width is bigger than the isotope shift. And so these two beautiful lines are now blended into one big line. Sorry. And so what do? Well, you don't give up. You just have to work harder. So the strategy is, what you got to do is measure the line profile very carefully. Because if you have more lithium 7, it wants to pull the profile one way. And if you want to have more lithium 6, it wants to pull the profile the other way. And so if you measure the profile very accurately, this line shape tells you about the ratio. And I'm afraid this doesn't reproduce very well, so it's a little bit hard to see. You've got these data points here, different theory curves where lithium 6 goes from 0 to 10%. And I don't know, so it's a little hard for the eye to see what's going on, but they show the residuals. And the 5% number here does the best job of minimizing the residuals. So they do some kind of chi-squared analysis, and they find evidence for lithium 6 in this star. But that's the game. You're looking for very small effects around the line shape. That's life. That's the thing you can observe, so you do the best you can. That's it. And these guys have tried very hard to look for all possible systematics and convince themselves this is the real thing.
There are many observations of lithium 7, and
yeah.
No clear evidence for lithium 6. If you combine them together and analyze somehow, can you put a strong...
co-add the data as a way to... Yeah.
So create some templates for the lines that, you know... measure the asymmetry, right? And if you measure it over many stars, you may gain an insight on what you know. Because if there would be an undetectable asymmetry,
right.
It would be undetectable in one star. But if you combine them many, right? You may gain. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know what you think, Carson, but to the extent that the main thing is you have to believe that you're looking at stars that are identical otherwise, so that you're not confusing with other effects. So they have to have similar rotation rates, because rotation can screw this up as well. Rotation rates, metallicity. It would have to be a very, very well chosen sample. I mean, I like the idea, but it'd have to be a very, very well chosen sample so that you can believe that you're not being confused by other effects. But on the other hand, in general, just looking at very big spectra of a large number of stars is exactly how you hope to get at some of these systematics. Just compare different stars with different rotation rates and see what you get. So I think the general idea is exactly right. Get a bunch of statistics and then try to look for the systematics.
That was my point. Because I think what the stage they are at right now is that actually they would like to make a model of the atmosphere individually for each star. Because those asymmetries can also be generated by convective motion.
Yeah, I'm about to say that.
You need the 3D model.
Yeah. Okay. So let me just show you. I was just showing you what a spectrum looks like. Now let me show you the actual abundances. So here, this is lithium ratios as a function, once again, of metallicity. And so this is from this Aspen paper. So the red points are where they only will assign an upper limit, but then the blue points are supposed to be detections. And so, lo and behold, they declare that they see a fair number of stars with the non-zero lithium abundances. And it looks like the 6-to-7 ratio is about constant over this very small population of stars. So there are several points to be made about this. It's fantastic that this can even be done. We actually can detect lithium 6, or at least hope to detect lithium 6. In these plateau stars over a range of metallicities. It's also worth noting that this number is small. This is a 6-to-7 ratio, and the number is like 10% large compared to these numbers. So lithium 6 is underabundant compared to lithium 7, which after all is the standard Big Bang nucleosynthesis result. So that tells you when you look at elemental lithium, you're mostly looking at lithium 7, which we've actually sort of been assuming all along. And then finally, because the ratios look similar across all these few detections, the fact that there's a plateau in elemental lithium then also means that there's a plateau in each element. And so here they're separated out. Here's the lithium 6 as a function of lithium 6 only now as a function of metallicity, and it looks like it too has a plateau. So there are both upper limits and then the big dots are in that detection. And so if you take all this at face value, it would suggest this presence of a plateau would suggest that there's primordial lithium 6. Now, I should point out, Carson was just alluding to this. This is a hard problem, and so the last word has certainly not been said. So a competing group, KREL, looked at the effect of convective motions in the photosphere. To be fair, Asplund is perfectly aware of this and talked about it, but Cayrell argues that this effect is more important than was indicated in the Asplund paper. But just the basic idea is the star is convective, so that it's boiling at its surface. The sun does this as well. And so that leads to Doppler shifts in the lines. So the upwelling material gets redshifted, the blue-shifted, downshifting material gets redshifted. And so it's sort of like in the sun. So here's a sunspot in the sun. And the reason that the sunspot is a spot is this region is dark because it's cooler gas that doesn't get to get replenished by the churning material here. So the bottom line is this generates an asymmetry, and it tends to boost the red signal, which mimics lithium 6. And so that's what we're worried about. And in fact, Krell is they're rather circumspect. They finish their paper not saying that there isn't lithium 6, but that the whole the status of lithium 6 has these kind of effects have to be thought of more, and the whole thing needs to be revisited. And that's about where it stands. So basically, lithium 6 is sort of at the edge of what we're able to do, and we're still sorting out these sort of higher order effects that up to now people haven't had to worry about at this level of detail. That's where we are, in my view. That's right. Absolutely. That's right. Absolutely.
I mean, yeah. Asplund made the point that there were lots of stars he sees that there isn't any. And so they have to look at the same stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no disagreement for me. I'm just, that's, you know.
The thing that I found more convincing in the Cayrell paper is when they include these 3D effects, it also explains why the actual feature you see is shifted. Because in the Asplund, they have to artificially shift their line to fit it. But Cayrell doesn't have to shift anything to a model.
Yeah.
So it really seems like these convective motions have to be taken into account, and not already there are going to be degenerate lithium 6. So you can kind of say, okay, well, maybe Asplund's lithium 6 are all upper abundant.
Asplund has the same 3D code.
Yeah, see, it's right. So I would say the situation is unsettled. It's clear that there are a lot of effects, and this is going to be hard to
say. Asplund also assumes something about the line shapes of pure, so not the blended stuff, but the pure stuff. And if you relax those assumptions, then we reproduce the Cayrell. I think that's the difference. Is this assumption systematic?
He assumes something about the line.
Yeah, they measure the line profile based on iron, and they assume that line profile holds for lithium 6 and lithium 7.
Individually.
Yes. Asplund assumes this. They assume this line shape, whereas Cayrell allows the line shape to vary individually.
I'm assuming differently, but I did ask Martin Asplund in the email because I was shocked that Cayrell paid for it. Maybe
I think Asplund is more restrictive in their fitting. Asplund is more restrictive in their fitting. They've assumed certain broadening effects aren't important, and the shape of lines is not significant.
Well, the good news is he is looking at it now. They were about to publish another paper a half year ago, and he does revisit the problem because they have more stars now too, and he is one of the persons which.
Yeah, I mean, he's one of the experts in the subject actually. So, you know, there's going to be progress here, but we'll understand more. Although we may just understand the systematics are very large, but there's going to be progress. But I would say we're not. This subject is not closed. But all right, just to move on, so now you have some sense of the observations, so the good, the bad, and the ugly.
And now we need, so first of all, we know that we've got to have galactic sources of lithium, beryllium, and boron, and then we'd like to have some pre-galactic sources. So let me say a little bit about the galactic sources. And so this is the subject dear to my heart going way back in my career, cosmic ray nucleosynthesis, which is a long and storied subject, and Grant could easily give this talk. So the idea is very simple. The galaxy contains cosmic rays, non-thermal particles, the blue-collar cosmic rays, sort of typical cosmic rays, sort of a GEV, mildly relativistic. They run through the galaxy, and they interact with the interstellar medium. So you can think of interstellar gas as a beam dump for cosmic rays. And we know for sure, so first of all, just because we measure cosmic rays on Earth and we know that there's an interstellar medium, that should actually already be enough. But in case you're concerned whether these interactions occur, we see them in the gamma ray sky. So this is the gamma ray sky. This is the EGRIT instrument. That's the one that's, that flew about a decade ago, 15 years ago. And this is a plot of the gamma ray sky above 100 MeV. So this is, you see the whole sky. And it's color coded, so all the bright part here is here, and then there's it's dim towards the poles, but not zero. So sorry, this is the galactic plane. So it's so you see the galactic plane. This is in galactic coordinates. So the galactic plane here is lit up in high energy gamma rays. Although we'll eventually care that at the poles the emission is not zero. But for now, concentrate on the galactic plane. And we're seeing that there's an enormous emission from the galactic plane. In fact, that's mostly what you see in the high-energy gamma-ray sky. And what you're seeing is the result of cosmic rays interacting with the interstellar medium. Why? Because cosmic rays are mostly proton. The interstellar medium is mostly hydrogen. When those two things collide, you make a pi zero, which actually does make a delta resonance, and it decays into a proton and a pi zero. And then the pi zero decays to two photons. And you're seeing the result there. And why do you see them in the galactic plane? Well, the cosmic rays are born in the galactic plane. They propagate rather diffusively, but the targets, the gas they're going to hit, is very sharply concentrated in the galactic plane. And lo and behold, that's what you see. So you're seeing ongoing cosmic ray interactions with the interstellar medium throughout the galaxy. But not only do cosmic ray interactions with the interstellar medium produce unstable things, which we can then observe, they make stable things. In particular, there are two kinds of processes. One is spallation, which is billiards. So a cosmic ray proton, say, or maybe an alpha, will hit interstellar heavy elements like carbon, nitrogen, or oxygen. And then it's just billiards where you knock away a few nucleons. And so if you start, say, with carbon-12 and knock off a nucleon, you get boron-11. Or if you knock off a few more, you can get beryllium-9 and so forth. And so this process can produce all of lithium, beryllium, and boron. Those are all final states of these processes. Oh, no, I didn't. Because the other
okay.
Checks in the mail. So the other process is cosmic rays contain helium. The interstellar medium contains helium. Those can interact. Now, this is a fusion process. Now, we've got a total of 8 nucleons to work with. So we don't want to throw them away. We want to get them to stick together. And if you just count on your fingers and toes, if you only have 8 nucleons to work with, you can't make beryllium-9 or any boron species. But as Grant well knows, you can make both species of lithium and only lithium. So spallation and fusion are fundamentally different in terms of what they can make, and we will care about that. OK, so now we can do galactic cosmic ray archaeology. So you can view lithium, beryllium, and boron as cosmic ray dosimeters. They measure the dose of cosmic radiation that you get. And so for the solar, back in the 70s, we first were just understanding the solar lithium, beryllium, and boron abundances. And those are trying to tell you the cumulative cosmic irradiation, cosmic ray irradiation, up to the time of the birth of the sun. And indeed, galactic cosmic rays are the only known conventional nucleosynthesis source for lithium-6, beryllium-9, and boron-10. So the lithium-6 in your computer batteries, if it's not cosmological, the only conventional source is from cosmic ray interactions. It came from cosmic ray interactions. It turns out that if you want to do a complete picture, it turns out that I didn't quite tell the truth when I said stars don't make lithium, beryllium, and boron. There's, in supernovae, it turns out the neutrinos can also do a spallation process in the atmosphere of the supernova itself, and that leads to lithium-7 and boron-11. That's not terribly important for the purposes of this. It doesn't change any of the conclusions, but I have some obligation to mention it because it's also very cool. So. So this is for the early galaxy. That's what you have, and that's right. For the lithium is also made in each of these stars. So that's the solar abundances in halo stars. Now looking back to low metallicity, what we're then seeing is cosmic ray fossils. So the very fact that there's, we only know beryllium, the only known source of beryllium is cosmic rays. And so the very fact that you see beryllium in low metallicity stars tells you that cosmic rays were present in the early galaxy, which maybe isn't a surprise, but it's kind of beautiful to see. And so lithium, beryllium, and boron are really trying to encode the cosmic ray history of the galaxy. There's a whole talk one could give on this, but the long story short is it is possible to build models, and now that's what the lines are supposed to be doing, to build models where you let cosmic rays live in the galaxy over the history of the galaxy and see if you can't explain what's going on. And that's more or less possible, and it actually ends up telling you things about the nature of cosmic rays. But the main thing is it is possible to build models to understand the galactic, non-primordial, non-pre-galactic component. That's the main thing. All right?
Excuse me, but only about the gamma ray sky pictures. Maybe I think that it's impossible to distinguish it from the inverse Compton by accelerating.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. I'll say a little bit more about that.
So it may affect the normalization of proton.
Oh, yeah. So that's, and in fact, when you do that, the details of the cosmic rays, there's a whole talk on that where you worry about things like that. For now, I just want to indicate that there are these processes going on. Oh, yeah, so let me just emphasize how this works for lithium. So the
interchange between cosmic rays and pre-galactic lithium. So the idea is cosmic rays, galactic cosmic rays, but even other cosmic rays will pollute primordial lithium. The lithium you observe, even though lithium-7, will have a cosmic ray component as well as a Big Bang nucleosynthesis component. But the beauty is, at least for galactic cosmic rays, we know what's going on with galactic cosmic rays because they produce beryllium and boron, and we can measure that. And so by using beryllium and boron, we can identify how much lithium 6 and 7 were made by galactic cosmic rays and subtract out the contamination to get the primordial amount. This is something that attempts to do that. So this is a model where there's a primordial component of lithium, and then there's a cosmic ray component in some neutrino process, and you add them all up. And it gives you, they didn't put in the AGB stars that Grant mentioned, so it doesn't go all the way up to there because that's where the AGB stars are. But what this does is this gives you an idea of how you do this. So that's great. But because, and this, I mentioned this before, that since the observed lithium you see in halo stars has a cosmic ray component as well as a nucleosynthesis component, that means the true pre-galactic or primordial component is lower, and it makes the WMAP problem worse. Sorry. And also, this predicts that lithium 6, I didn't plot this here, but it predicts that lithium 6 should rise with metallicity. It's been produced in the galaxy. It shouldn't have a plateau. And it looks like it underpredicts lithium 6 at the lowest metallicities. So the lithium 6 is not looking very good. If the lithium 6 observations are taken at face value, then it's hard to reconcile with this cosmic ray picture. Although this cosmic ray picture has to be producing lithium 6, but there might be an additional source as well. All right? Okay, and that leads us then to the additional source. How am I doing on time, Nick? Okay, and then just stop me. So we need pre-galactic sources of lithium, and I won't say much about the dark matter because you guys all know about that. So let me focus on another pre-galactic source that one might worry about, and that is structure formation itself produces lithium, or it should produce lithium, and that's just a beautiful idea. Because structure formation, it turns out, is a particle accelerator, because structure formation generates shocks. Hydrodynamic shocks, gas dynamical shocks in the universe. So the idea is as follows. So we're in the regime of structure formation now. So you imagine the people who do it would call it the early universe. It's not early for us. It's not Big Bang nucleosynthesis early, but it's after recombination. It's when structure starts to form. So the universe contains dark matter potentials, and then the baryons, after recombination, the baryons are able to fall onto the dark matter potentials. And it turns out if the potentials are large enough, the baryons can start to fall pretty rapidly. And if the infall speed is bigger than the sound speed, this generates shocks. And in fact, that can and does occur. And in fact, simulations see this happening all the time. This is a simulation of a of a galaxy cluster, so it's a little hard to tell. There's a little box here, and there's this is a numerical simulation of the formation of a galaxy cluster. And then all around it, it's enclosed by the shocks that are generated by baryonic material falling onto the onto the protocluster. And so, in fact, it looks like structure formation generates shocks all over the place. And in fact, the cosmic web of structures should be enclosed, sort of sheathed by shocks. And they have a rather, as you can see, they have a rather complex geometry. You can see the strands of the cosmic web feed in, and they all generate shocks. And you get a whole range of Mach numbers. That's what this is. So Mach numbers up to 30, so from weak to very strong shocks. This has been worked out in simulations, and we and other people have looked at this in analytic approaches as well. So the why do I care? So I was talking about lithium. Now I'm talking about shocks. Why do I care about that? Is the shocks that we're talking about are high Mach number. They're long lived and large power because they're high Mach number. Because I just showed you that they're long lived because they live on cosmological scales, and an enormous amount of power goes through them. So this is a plot of that power. As a function of redshift, this is the shocks that I'm talking about. This is the amount of power going through them in foes per century, 10 to the 51 ergs per century. And what you might want to compare that is the amount of power generated in the universe from supernovae, and that's this curve here. And so cosmic shocks they're generating more luminosity than all of the supernovae in the universe. And so, why do you care? Well, the key thing is shocks, astrophysical shocks, are sites of particle acceleration. We see this all the time. We see it in the solar system. We see it in supernova remnants. Astrophysical shocks accelerate particles. And indeed, that's the mechanism we believe that lets supernovae accelerate the normal galactic cosmic rays. But now, if there's this other component of shocks that has an enormous amount of energy, structure formation itself, by generating shocks, will also, should also accelerate cosmic rays. So this may well be an inevitable fact of baryonic life. You build structures, you generate shocks, you accelerate particles. And this acceleration would begin before galaxies are born, potentially before any halo stars are born. And there's some indication that this has already been seen in clusters. So this is a non-thermal emission from a cluster that looks like it's associated with electrons accelerated in a shock. This is actually inverse Compton. So if the universe, through the process of structure formation, is generating cosmic rays, they can do nuclear synthesis. But now it's tricky, because we've got what's accelerated is just cosmic baryons. And so they have a primordial composition. And they're running into things that have a primordial composition, if we're talking about early in the universe. And so now only the alpha-alpha process, Grant's favorite process, that's the only process that occurs. So we only get lithium-6 and lithium-7, no beryllium and boron. Which means that beryllium and boron now cannot tell you what the cosmic rays were doing. They don't independently constrain that. And there's no correlation with metals, so we can't use metals to find out how much was going on. So this would create pre-galactic lithium-6 and lithium-7. And then you might worry, because now how do you know that it's, how do you distinguish this from the primordial amount? Because now there's no beryllium and boron or metals or some other way of knowing how much the cosmic rays were doing. And that is where gamma rays come in. And so what we want to do now is paleolithography, which is to say we want to understand the prehistory of cosmic rays. And this is work with Tiana Pradanovich. And so the idea is we're worried or interested in, depending on your point of view, this process where structure formation through fusion generates lithium-6. Well, now we want to sort of turn the problem around. If interactions produce lithium-6, with alpha interactions produce lithium-6, then proton interactions produce pi zeros, which produce gamma rays. So let's now turn the problem around and let's focus on the gamma rays. The gamma rays that are produced, these would be produced everywhere in the universe. And so if you take your telescope and point it out, you will see the net contribution of all gamma rays produced by all cosmic rays across all cosmological cosmic rays across the universe. The lithium, so it turns out to be a measurement of the integrated flux of gamma rays of cosmic rays, which is the cosmic ray fluence. Lithium also measures the cosmic ray fluence. It's also a dosimeter, but it measures the fluence locally as opposed to along the line of sight. But the beautiful thing is, first of all, from the cosmological principle, you're able to relate the two, or at least hope you can. And otherwise, the ratios are of lithium to gamma rays are completely determined by cross sections. And those are something we actually understand. That's where we can actually do some real physics. And so the beauty is, since there's a fixed ratio of lithium to cosmic gamma rays, you can use one to probe the other. In particular, you can use the cosmic gamma ray background. The high energy gamma ray background is telling you how much gamma rays were made throughout the universe. You can then use this ratio to work out how much, so you measure these gammas and then infer how much lithium-6 was made, or lithium-7. And so it turns out, so that's a really nice thing to do. In terms of there's even other ideas for where cosmological cosmic rays could come from, this procedure works for both. It turns out we did this, and what we hoped is that the gamma ray background would be such that you could immediately rule out interesting levels of lithium production. But it turns out the current gamma ray data are not good enough to exclude a large pre-galactic component. If you could do a better job with the gamma ray data, you could beat this down. But at the moment, if you're generous, you cannot robustly rule out a large pre-galactic production from cosmic rays.
Maybe there are some uncertainty to normalize the proton and alpha electrons, accelerated electron, accelerated proton, and accelerated alpha.
Oh, yeah.
Unknown the ratio. Yeah, it doesn't reflect the primordial abundance of proton helium or. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So certainly, that's right. So the main factor that determines this ratio is just cross section, but you're right. You also have to be concerned about, you need to know something about the relative abundances of the alphas and the protons in the beams.
Yes.
But the thing is, because you're dealing with the primordial composition, that's certainly what's assumed here. You're dealing with the primordial composition.
But according to the second Fermi acceleration theory, it doesn't reflect the primordial abundance because it depends on the initial momentum or something at the accelerator.
Yeah, so that's right. So ultimately, this reflects something about so you need to know something about what is the composition of the accelerated particles. And that's a whole subject by itself. Looking at, based on what we know about supernovae, what you see is that the composition reflects the composition of the shock medium. So it's not actually the supernova ejected that gets shocked, it's the medium. It's the interstellar, the cosmic rays look like accelerated interstellar medium. So based on that observed fact, we said, okay, let's say that the cosmological cosmic rays are telling you, are the accelerated intergalactic or pre-galactic medium. That's the assumption that goes into this. But you're right, and that's the sort of thing that you'd like to know more about. Okay, so we're just about out of time. Okay, so this is just because we did, we spent a lot of time working on this. People who are interested, can lithium be Susie? Let's just, well, you all know what the issues behind us, indeed all the talks will be about this. So
we're all interested in whether or not there's this Susie sweet spot. Okay, in the remaining two, don't worry, I'm almost done. I just wanted to talk a little bit about future experiments and observations that can hope to push some of this stuff forward. And particularly something that may not be as familiar to everybody is GLASS, which is the Gamma Ray Large Area Space Telescope that is going to give us new information about gamma rays in our own galaxy and throughout the universe. It looks at gamma rays from 20 MeVs to almost a TeV, so it's an enormous dynamic range. And they'll do much better than the gamma ray plot I showed you before. They'll have much better angular resolution, spectral resolution. They should do a very nice job, or certainly a much better job, of working out this diffuse gamma ray background that will help us understand what's going on in the intergalactic medium. And the launch is now scheduled for June 5th, 2008, which is the same, if I do the calculation right, as Thursday. So this is about to go up. This is going to happen. So that's on the gamma ray side. And the laboratory side, I don't need to tell you guys, the LHC is about to turn on. That's going to, I don't even need to tell you. It'll do fantastic things. That was my excuse to show a pretty LHC picture. And then finally, I just wanted to give a little plug on the observational side. I mean, there's a lot of work that we need on sort of abundance observations. But in terms of lithium, I just wanted to mention something. This is, once again, Tiana did a very nice job here. So clearly we're systematics dominated, and so when you're systematic dominated, it's nice to have other approaches. You want to understand the systematics and the systems you already have, but you'd like to have some completely different system with some, it surely has systematics, but different systematics, and compare the two, and maybe you can learn something. And so what we just pointed out is, this is an all-sky picture again, this is our galaxy, this is now, these are what are so-called high-velocity clouds. These are seen in neutral hydrogen, 21-centimeter emission. So these are clouds of baryonic material that's falling onto our galaxy with high velocity. It's being accreted by our galaxy. The idea is, if you look through the denser regions of these clouds, you can actually determine abundances. And in fact, you can find that they're low metallicity and they have a deuterium that's close to primordial. And so what we've suggested is these might be a nice site to look for lithium. And because this the gas is cold, it doesn't have this blending problem, and you really have to beat on them, but there's a potential to actually get isotopes from this. Then you can actually see lithium-6 and lithium-7, and that can that would be just a great thing to do in general, and potentially could give us some important new information about how the isotopes play on each other and how they relate to the metallicity and so forth. Okay, whoops, I don't know why they did that. All right, well, I told you that that those are my conclusions, so now my outline was my conclusions, so they really are, so I now will just leave you with my conclusions. We do see lithium-6, beryllium, boron in stars, at least we try to, and there's some evidence for pre-galactic lithium-6. Beryllium and boron, it's not as clear, but you can at least set some upper limits. We definitely know there need to be galactic production of lithium, beryllium, and boron, and indeed, cosmic rays seem to fit the bill pretty well. On the pre-galactic side, everybody knows about dark matter, and we'll be hearing much more about that. But there are also post-dark matter, but still very interesting, high-energy processes coming from structure formation itself. And those will compete, and we'll need to be aware of this. And with any luck, with some gamma rays, perhaps, disentangle the two. So thanks very much.
We have that much time for questions, because we will stay out of
time. I want your questions talk.
Maybe one or two short questions.
It sounds very interesting. You need your own time, Carson. What you proposed the last slide sounds very interesting. It's a high velocity cloud.
Yeah.
How difficult is it?
A lot. So we've been working with some observers, and it's very hard. The main thing, the conceptually, it's not hard at all. It's just what you end up having to do is these clouds are just living, you know, in the high latitudes of the galaxy, and because they're falling onto the galaxy, you can't use galactic stars. I mean, you're trying to see, you need something behind the cloud to light up that you can then look through the cloud, because they're not glowing on their own, except for radio. So what you have to do is you have to use a quasar, and quasars just aren't that bright. I mean, compared to galactic stars, and so it's just a very difficult business, and it just takes a lot of telescope time. And so it's feasible. So actually what we're trying to do is just establish, forget even isotopes, we just want to establish that this can be done. And once if you can show that it can be done, then we can maybe hope to talk some people in that have big telescope time to then really beat on this to maybe hope to actually see some isotopes. Anyway, it's your time.
Well, I assume I like that.